This sounds like art.
Art.
Art. Art and his take on it.
I'm an artist of liberation.
Everybody wants to be an artist.
Art history.
Art history.
The making of art.
Art history with Lorraine Kipiotis.
Well, I wonder if you heard the news a couple of weeks back that a painting by Gustav Klimt had sold at Sotheby's for a record-breaking $236.4 million, that'd be Aussie dollars, making it one of the most expensive artworks ever sold at auction. Now, Gustav Klimt was a very controversial, you might be surprised to learn that he was, but he was a controversial turn-of-the-century painter. And while his life scandalised conservative Viennese society, his paintings fascinated members of the city's elite, and they all went to see him to have their portraits painted. Now, the painting that we're talking about here, it's a 1.8-metre a portrait of someone called Elizabeth Ladera, which was painted over 3 years by Klimt between 1914 and 1916. It is a painting that speaks to power, elegance, and the confidence of Vienna's high society in the early 20th century. Well, the painting, though, like the subject and the artist, has a fascinating history. It was seized by the Nazis. It escaped being destroyed in a fire during the Second World War. And the beautiful Elizabeth Ladera would also find her life turned upside down by the events of war. So here to tell you a bit more about this painting, a bit more about Klimt, because probably if you don't know much of his other work, you might be familiar with The Kiss. Dr. Lorraine Kipiotis is here from the National Art School. Lorraine, of course, is our regular art historian here on Nightline. Hello, Lorraine. Welcome back.
Hi, Suzanne. Good to be here.
So 236 million. Oh, no, that's US, not even Australian.
Yeah.
Oh,
actually, that equates, Suzanne, to about 365 million Australian dollars. Crazy, huh?
Oh, wow, you could build a few websites at the Bureau of Meteorology for that,
could, I reckon. You know, refurbish the whole of Sydney for that.
So is that the most expensive painting ever sold?
Close to it, but not quite. It actually comes in second after Leonardo da Vinci's Salvator Mundi, or Saviour of the World. And that sold in 2017 for 450 US million. So that's almost 700 mil Australian. But apparently it is the highest priced painting sold at auction for a modern painting, and knocked Andy Warhol's shot Sage Blue Marilyn off the pedestal. It sold, I think, in 2022 for around 300 mil Australian. So, yeah, most expensive modern painting. Crazy.
Wow. Also, and we'd all know, we'd have immediately in our mind that Marilyn Monroe painting, wouldn't we?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It is the quintessential screen print of Marilyn Monroe. Yeah.
Okay, but if we go to the Klimt, this and this is Klimt's record, the record price for a Klimt?
Well, this is, yes, it holds the record for a Klimt, certainly. If we're talking just about the auction process here, it doubled his last sale at auction, which was about 108 million. That was Lady with a Fan that sold in 2023. Mm-hmm. But in terms of private sales, it's still the highest, but in private sales, Klimt's Woman in Gold, which I think everyone is probably familiar with, that's the Adele Bloch Bauer one painting, that beautiful shimmery gold painting, that sold back in 2006 in a private sale for about 696 million Australian.
What?
Yeah, I know. It's
okay. His work is worth a lot. That is the bottom line here. Now, tell us who bought this one in 2006, because this is interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, the 2006 one, that was actually bought by, and this is quite ironic, it was sold to Ronald Lauder, and he put it in his new gallery in New York City. And basically he, you know, shows it there, hopefully in perpetuity, so everyone can get a look at it. Because, you know, I really think it's a crime, Suzanne, when someone buys a painting and it does go into a private collection and no one ever gets to see it again, well, the general public anyway. But Ronald was actually the brother of Leonard Lauder, from whose estate the portrait of Elizabeth Ladera belonged. He died only in June this year. And his art collection, which actually included two other Klimt paintings, two beautiful landscapes, was only auctioned, as you mentioned, you know, a couple of weeks ago.
Right. So that's how it's come to market. It's the fact that Leonard Lauder died. Now, Lauder, that's a name people might be familiar with, particularly if they buy cosmetics.
Yes, yes. Both these guys, they're related to Estée Lauder. And they were actually the sons, her sons.
Oh, wow.
And Estée Lauder, of course, started the incredible cosmetics firm. And they were her heirs, her and her husband's heirs. And of course, they used a lot of their money to put together an art collection.
Okay. So this painting, it has just sort of like a web of people, interesting people that have been connected to it in its
yeah,
story.
Yeah, yeah. Look, in many ways, Suzanne, I think this story is more than just about a painting and more than just an artist as well. I mean, it's really about what happens to that painting beyond the artist, once it leaves the artist, where it goes, who it comes into contact with, you know, the sitter, the family, the buyers, the collectors, the people who even loot, you know, the painting, who sees the painting in war times. And it's almost as though the painting itself has a life. You know, and where it ends up in the end.
Dr. Lorraine Kipiotis is here on Nightlife. She's from the National Art School. We're talking Gustav Klimt tonight, particularly because you might have heard about this huge portrait of someone called Elisabeth Ladera, which sold at auction a couple of weeks ago for this record-breaking amount. Now, let's go back, Lorraine, and just talk a bit more about Klimt and who he was.
Okay, well, Gustav Klimt, he's an interesting artist because he really spans that turn of the 20th century into the 19th, turn of the 20th century. So he becomes basically an archetypal sensualist who portrays very much Vienna's elite in very gilded and decorative finery, but he was also a disruptor. You know, he trained in a very formal, traditional manner, very much a classical painter, and started off in that mode. But then, along with a lot of other young artists in Vienna, started off the Vienna Secessionist group, and they basically wanted to sweep away the existing order of, you know, what they saw as intellectual and artistic stagnation and bring something new. They saw, you know, everything that was happening in the rest of Europe, you know, Matisse and the Fauves, and in France, and, you know, Vincent van Gogh and Gauguin, and they really wanted to be part of this, you know, sort of new movement. So he really becomes a disruptor in adopting a very modernist and decorative style, and a very sensual style too. A lot of his paintings, not so much his portraits, but certainly a lot of his paintings of women are quite erotic. You know, he portrays the nude. Now, the nude has been portrayed for centuries already in art, but generally in a mythological guise, or even, you know, a religious guise in Eve. But Klimt is portraying real women, and he's not only portraying real women who look out of the picture plane at the viewer and engage with them, but he's also representing women who are pregnant, women who are old. And a lot of the time, society was shocked and the critics were shocked, not so much at the nudity, but the fact that you know, he was depicting pregnancy, which had never, you know, pretty much been depicted in art, or what they termed ugliness sometimes. Mm. In the aged body, which
it's like Demi Moore pregnant on the cover of Vogue, but 100 years earlier.
Exactly.
Yeah. So before we get more into Klimt, just sort of paint a picture of Vienna at the time, because Vienna, it's a very rich place, but it's also very ordered, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Very ordered. It's still part of the Habsburg Empire at this stage. It's opulent. It's beautiful. Anyone who's been to Vienna will have seen, you know, obviously the layout of the city, the beautiful 19th and 18th century classical buildings, the Vienna Opera, the galleries. It's a gorgeous city, but very well ordered, you know, very staid, very conservative. But simmering underneath that facade was this unease. And you've got to remember also, Suzanne, this is the time of Sigmund Freud. He's practicing in Vienna, you know, the father of psychoanalysis, and all of his theories about, you know, the eroticism of the human being as well. And Klimt in many ways is Freud's counterpart in art. And he's starting to depict some of that, you know, those issues that Freud's talking about in his psychoanalytical works in painting.
So, Lorraine, if everyone was shocked, oh my goodness, he's got this pregnant nude painting and all this other stuff's going on. Vienna's elite, though, that didn't put them off. They wanted to have their portrait done by him.
No, that didn't put them off because, you know, Klimt's out there, he's in the public eye, he's the man of the moment. He's also friends with a lot of these elite, the elite class. And, of course, they all want their portrait done by the latest painter and in the most contemporary manner whatsoever. So, you know, when we look back at these portraits, the portrait of Elisabeth Lederer or of Adele Bloch-Bauer, the woman in gold, we can really appreciate them for their decorative qualities. But at the time, when you think about it, you know, those early decades, the two early decades of the 1900s, they were quite shocking and quite disruptive. But I can see why art collectors who were collecting contemporary work would want the up-to-the-minute work.
So what does the work, this Elizabeth Lederer portrait, what does it look like? Can you describe it?
It's quite a beautiful one. Unlike Adele Bloch-Bauer that shimmers in gold, this one is, it's still beautifully decorative, but it also, I think, pulses with a more psychologically charged intensity. Again, Elizabeth Lederer, she's a young woman. She's about 20 when Klimt started the work. And she's looking out, standing upright, looking out of a picture plane at the audience. She's wearing a beautiful gown, a white gown, a top and a skirt. And then she has a lovely chiffon drape over that. Again, very, very decorative. But around that, she wears a cloak, a blue cloak that falls from her shoulders. And it is decorated in beautiful Asian motifs and Asian symbolism. And you can see at this particular time, Klimt was quite taken with Asian motifs. There was a great influence in his work. Similarly, when he painted Adele Bloch-Bauer in all that shimmering gold, he had just been to Ravenna and seen the beautiful gold mosaics there. So, you know, we've got all these influences playing into his art, and he's reflecting that in his portraits. But what the cloak does, and around Elizabeth, encircling her up more Asian motifs. You've got warriors, scholars, soldiers on horses, ladies in waiting. What it gives it is a sort of a gravitas and shows her as a very important and almost imperial young woman, someone who's, you know, a person of importance, as her family was. Her family, in fact, in Vienna at the time, I'm pretty sure were the second richest family after the Rothschilds in Vienna. And they had quite a lot of money, of course, and they spent a lot of it on collecting art.
Mm. And just to note that this was one of the last paintings Klimt did, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. He spent, he died in 1918. Basically, he had a stroke and died. He was only 55, 56. But he spent 3 years on the painting between 1914 and 1916. And it drove the family a little crazy. You know, the Lederers, the mother and father, Auguste and Serena, had commissioned the work. And in fact, Klimt had painted an earlier portrait of the mother, Serena, I think in about 1903, also a beautiful, beautiful work. And, you know, the story goes they were always, you know, knocking, the mother especially, knocking on Klimt's door, when are you going to finish this portrait, when are you going to finish it, come on, you know, we commissioned you 3 years ago, what's going on? In the end, she stormed into Klimt's studio, grabbed the work, no mean feat, it's a 1.8 metre painting, grabbed it, put it in her carriage and drove away with it. So Klimt still wasn't happy.
Wow. She still wanted to technically finish it. It was unfinished according to Klimt.
Yeah.
But that's what we see today.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And so what did the Lederers do with it once they actually had it in their grasp?
Oh, they loved it. They displayed it in their home along with, you know, other portraits by Klimt. And they owned, I think, something like 14 or 15, maybe, you know, somewhere around, you know, the high teens of Klimt's painting. So they just displayed it in their homes, and they only ever let it go out of their home once for an exhibition, I think, in Scandinavia in 1917 of Klimt's works.
Yeah. So they had some other Klimt works. Tell us about them as art collectors, family.
Well, you know, as I said, they collected a lot of his landscapes. He'd made a lot of portraits. He did a portrait of the mother. He did a portrait of Elizabeth Lederer, and he did a portrait of the grandmother as well throughout their lives. But they also owned, it was an incredible set of works called the University Paintings. Now, this was a public work that Klimt had been commissioned to do. And this was, you know, back in the late 1800s. And the Ministry of Education wanted to redecorate the University of Vienna. So they commissioned Klimt and another artist to produce some paintings. And Klimt had been assigned the subjects philosophy, medicine, and jurisprudence. Justice, law.
Mm.
And so they expected, of course, very dignified formal paintings and an accepted classical style, and Klimt incredibly just shocked them. And what they got caused a scandal. It was all over the Viennese newspapers, and it was really clear at this moment that Klimt had embarked on a whole new phase of expression in his work. I mean, there was nudity in it, there were monsters, pregnant women again.
Not what the university had been expecting.
Yeah, and the university were flabbergasted. Klimt was disgusted with their response. Mm. He actually bought them back from the university by repaying the commission and then sold them to Auguste Lederer, and they owned them. Now, sadly, they met a devastating end, Suzanne. They were amongst about 14 Klimt works that were seized by the Nazis, and they were stored at Schloss Immendorf, Immendorf Castle, which was destroyed after retreating SS troops set the castle alight to prevent it falling into the Allied the hands of the Allied forces at the end of World War II.
So all gone.
Yeah, and not only Klimt paintings, but many paintings that they'd stored there were destroyed.
Well, but the Elizabeth Lederer painting clearly wasn't among that lot because we still have it today. Why was it not there?
Yeah. Well thought out, Suzanne. No. Even though it was seized by the Nazis, it actually survived the war under the most peculiar circumstances. It's quite ironic, I think, that this painting that overflows with life and optimism and light and depicts this beautiful 20-year-old woman, her life actually takes a monumentally tragic turn as well within 15 years, and the war starts. And, you know, this was the thing about Klimt. He painted individuals and he reflected beautiful Viennese society, but he didn't really paint what was happening in the outside world. Mm. That didn't concern him so much. So her father dies in 1936. Nazi Germany annexes Austria in the Anschluss in 1938. They seize much of the Lederer's art collection.
Because they're Jewish, right?
Because they're Jewish, right. And they store most of it in Immendorf Castle, but not the portraits, because these portraits and the other Lederer family portraits and other others that belong to Jewish families, under Nazi regulations, portrait of Jewish sitters were considered not worth confiscating.
Because the painting is of a Jewish woman.
That's right.
They don't want to know about it.
No.
Wow.
So they stored these at a place called the Dorotheum Auction House. Mm-hmm. So during the Nazi years, the Dorotheum played a very important part in selling property that was seized from Jewish families by the Gestapo office. And that office was for the disposal of the property of Jewish immigrants. So they were kept there, so they didn't burn, luckily.
And the Lederers themselves?
Oh, the Lederers went into exile. They were forced into exile, but not Elizabeth. Elizabeth decides she's going to stay in Vienna. She refuses to leave, much to her own peril. Now, you would think that she'd be immediately seized, but she had converted to Protestantism. When in 1921 she'd actually married Wolfgang von Backofen-Echt, who was the heir to an Austrian brewery. But they had divorced in 1934, so she'd reverted to Judaism. So technically she's Jewish, okay? So facing persecution and likely death, and in this extraordinary act of self-preservation, she falsely claims, well, we think falsely, claims that Klimt, that Gustav Klimt, who's a non-Jewish artist, who's known for his many illicit affairs, was actually her biological father.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So and he's dead, long dead by this time, so he can't say, hang on, no.
Yeah, he died at the end of World War One. Mm. Okay, so he can't say no. And we do know that Klimt fathered possibly around 17 illegitimate children.
What?
He never married. He had one longtime mistress who he, you know, fessed up to having two children with. He took responsibility for three, but he had many, many models and many mistresses. So they reckon
he
around
was
17
spreading his
children.
DNA around. So quite clearly this story could have been true.
Could have been true. That's right. So she circulates a story that Klimt's her real father. Now, you know, of course, certain elements of that story, his reputation as a philanderer, his obsessive commitment to painting Elizabeth, to not allowing the painting out of his studio, and the very fact that she had also trained as an artist and a sculptor in her own right, gave a lot of credence to this, you know, supported the idea. Now, Elizabeth's mother also supports this idea. She willingly signs an affidavit saying that Klimt was her father.
I wonder though, I mean, I understand that the notion of Judaism is passed through the mother. So if her mother is clearly Jewish.
Yeah. I know. Now, I think this might have been her saving grace. Elizabeth has a former brother-in-law who's actually a high-ranking Nazi official. And he is able to facilitate the issuing of a document stating that she descended from Klimt and that she wasn't Jewish. So that allowed her to live unharmed in Vienna. Now, She sadly dies in 1944. Just from, I think, natural causes and but quite suddenly. Mm. So she doesn't even see the war out anyway.
So just back to Klimt, though, for a moment, if she's saying, look, I'm descended from him, would the Nazis, him not being Jewish, have regarded his art as valuable and important and had some admiration for him?
Absolutely, Suzanne. They really loved his art. You know, we've spoken before about the degenerate art exhibition that they put on in 1939 when they confiscated a lot of modernist art. But they saw Klimt, because he was non-Jewish, as an artist to be touted. So they
even though he had the pregnant women in it.
Yeah, even though. So, you know, he was the artist to look at, not the other one. So this sort of also helped very much Elizabeth's case.
Okay, so if she can draw a link with Klimt, then that's good in the eyes of the Nazis. Okay, so Elizabeth dies. What happened to the painting then?
Oh, okay, so it stays in the Dorotheum. Then after the war, by 1948, I think, it's restituted to Eric Lederer, Elizabeth's brother. She had two brothers, but Eric himself survived. I think he was in exile in Switzerland. And so some of the paintings, some of the Lederer's paintings are restituted to Eric. Now, Eric himself had his portrait painted many times, not by Klimt, but by Klimt's friend and fellow artist, Egon Schiele, who was also an up-and-coming young artist, but who also sadly died, I think, in around 1918 from the Spanish flu epidemic. And he keeps the painting, all the paintings, pretty much up until 2 years before he dies. So he sells them in 1983 to an art dealer, Serge Sabarsky. Then 2 years later, once Eric dies, they're put up for auction, and that painting becomes part of the private collection of Leonard Lauder.
Okay, so this is Estée Lauder's son who buys it.
Right. And he buys that in 1985. His brother doesn't buy Woman in Gold until 2006. Mm. So both brothers essentially own a lot of beautiful Klimt works and two of his major portraits.
And I like this. Leonard apparently liked to have breakfast sitting near the painting.
Yes, which is so nice. I mean, he hung it in his apartment in New York. He used to have a little table right underneath the painting where he'd have breakfast, and he'd look at it every morning. And I think that's lovely. I often think, what would it be like to live with a great piece of work of art? I would look at it every day as well.
Absolutely. You
know? Yeah.
Okay, so if we go back to Klimt then, what had happened to Klimt?
Oh, as I mentioned, he died only 2 years after completing the work, 1918, of a stroke, never married, had a couple of close relationships, one with his mistress and another one with a woman who was a fashion designer called Emily Floge. And she was both a designer and a businesswoman, and she became Klimt's lifelong companion. In fact, on his deathbed, just about his last words were, "Get Emily." Mm. And he left half of his estate to her, which was incredible. The other half went to his remaining family. But again, sadly, in the final days of the Second World War, her house caught on fire, destroying not only her historic collection of garments that she designed, but also valuable objects from his estate, Gustav Klimt's estate, including the bulk of the drawings that he had given her. Very, very sad.
Yeah, because he'd made sketches for nearly all of the paintings that he did.
Oh, he had made sketches for everything he did. Sometimes there were over 100 drawings just for one painting. And, you know, we know that Klimt kept in his studio kept a lot of models just waiting around, and he would sketch the models as they were resting, reclining, chatting to each other, and he would often use these poses in his paintings. But luckily, he made probably around 4,000 drawings that actually survived the war years. So we have quite a lot of his collection. And I think somewhere around 245 paintings as well.
Now, where can we see the paintings today that remain? Obviously, some of them are in private collections.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, you can still see about 20 of them in the Belvedere in Vienna, and a beautiful collection. Of course, the Woman in Gold is in New York. Where's the Kiss? I think the Kiss is in Vienna.
In Vienna,
yeah, in the Belvedere, yeah. And I think the Woman in Gold, sort of as part of those beautiful gold shimmery paintings, was sat next to or close to the Kiss, actually, for some time. I know that there's one at the National Gallery in London, there's one in the Met. So, you know, they're sort of all over the place because people collected his beautiful work, and you know, and a lot was restituted after the Second World War, which was a great thing.
Yeah, what a story about this one painting. I mean, you talk about provenance, and that is an incredible story to go with that painting. So, Lorraine, thank you so much for coming into the Nightlife studio to tell it to us tonight.
Thanks, Suzanne. My pleasure.
Dr. Lorraine Kipiotis from the National Art School.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.